Welcome to First Things First. It is a Monday morning. I'm Jenna Wolf. That is the Hall of Famer, Chris Carter. That is Nick Wright. The bosses are in town. We got to be on good behavior today, but that'll be easy since we are talking football.
We'll see.
And more football. Lots to get to. A brutal loss for the Steelers last night. A big bounce back win for the Patriots. And a cowboy will beat a lion on any given Sunday. That's where we will kick off our show this morning. Cowboys and Lions and Ezekiel Elliott, the story in this one. He was unleashed, as we all thought he needed to be. Carried the ball 25 times, gained 240 total yards, and scored a touchdown. Most importantly, that 34-yard catch you just saw to set up that. The game-winning field goal. 26-24 was your final in this one. Dak Prescott threw for 255 yards and two touchdowns as the Dallas Cowboys now improve to 2-2. Here is Ezekiel Elliott discussing that pivotal catch after the game.
Honestly, I've been trying to get that play for a while. We ran it a couple of times in practice and it hit, but once I saw we got in a two-minute offense and they were playing man-to-man, they had a linebacker lined up on me in the slot, I just knew, I was telling the guys on sideline, give me the inside fade.
And you got Zeke on a linebacker. We're going to take that matchup any day of the week. Doesn't matter who the linebacker is.
Now that catch over his shoulder, when it all counted, should be one we all remember. And I'm glad I got to see it. But I've never seen him play any better than he played today.
2-2 is much better than 1-3, and it's it was great for us just to come out here, get things going offensively, and just be able to go down there and win that game on that last drive. It's big for everybody's confidence and just moving forward and momentum that we can take from this game and carry on.
Guys, we talked about it all week. The only way the Cowboys were going to win was if Ezekiel Elliott carried the ball more than 15 times. The game yesterday, 25 times. You saw it proved to be correct. See, was Zeke dominating the offense the formula for the Cowboys' success, in your opinion, yesterday?
Any offensive coach is trying to get the ball in his best player's hands as much as possible. When you are challenged as far as wide receivers, tight ends, explosive players, what else would you do? I don't know why it took them 4 weeks to get to this. This is the way they should play. What we talked about last week was Dallas's lack of an identity, and they needed every one of those yards, every one of those catches from Zeke. And this is the way they're going to have to win. If he gets worn out as the season goes on, that's okay, because if they don't, they're just going to be a 500 team. If they're going to make it to the playoffs, it's because their best player gets the most touches on that offense. That's the way they should start off every game. They should force defenses to be able to take Zeke out of the game. Make them, as they put a linebacker on, I don't think you can grow his receiving like you did as much. Don't look for them to be able to throw down the field 38 yards every game. No, but in this game, put him in the slot, you get one-on-one, you take advantage of it. But you can see even Zeke was a little surprised. He said they ran this a couple times in practice. So for me, this wasn't necessarily a game plan thing. It was something that the coverage dictated and Dak took advantage of it with them having man-to-man across the board.
Special players make special plays, and Zeke should have been surprised. In his NFL career, that's the first time he's ever been targeted more than 10 yards downfield. So whatever passes they've thrown to him, none of them have ever been more than 10 yards downfield until this play, and, man, he made it count. I mean, this was, this and the field goal, the biggest plays of the game. Maher has to go make that field goal, but this is exactly what we talked about. Jenna, you're right, because it wasn't just that hammering Zeke was effective. All of a sudden, they can take a few deep shots offensively outside of that play. They went into this football game with one pass play on the year greater than 20 yards. Yesterday, they had four greater than 30 yards. Like, it wasn't, there was a screen to Zeke, there was that play to Zeke, but Jeff Swaim had one, Michael Gallup had one, and if Dak's going to be effective, it's not going to be the 72% Drew Brees completions. It's going to have to be with some shots downfield. This is exactly what Dallas has to do. Now, a critic would say, you had Zeke's career best game, and it took a field goal at the gun
to win it.
To win, I get that. But they had to win. Philly couldn't win. Their division is all of a sudden they look at it, they say, okay, we're a game behind Washington or a half game behind Washington in our division. We'll deal with that. Zeke was outstanding. And if you're Dallas, you do have to have a little regret because you didn't give Zeke a chance to be this outstanding through 3 weeks. I also wonder why it took so long, but better late than never, I suppose.
Did you look at this Dallas team yesterday and say, well, they were much better than I've seen the last couple weeks? Or did Zeke just finally do the thing that he needed to do to help them win?
They did a couple more things. They weren't a lot better. I mean, if they don't complete this, if they don't have that drive, they lose. So I'm not going to change the whole narrative because they came up with the key drive. If you look at yesterday's action, it's about coming up with the key drive. A lot of these games are going to be very, very close. Do I expect Dallas to give up 23, 24 points every game? I expect their defense to be better. Now, they're not turning the ball over, and Dak, even when he had free runners in the backfield, making good decisions, but they have to build on this. They have to have Zeke involved in the passing game, and they have to have a concentrated effort to be able to get the ball down the field the way they did in this game. Because even with the two plays over 30 yards before Zeke makes his play, they would have lost this game.
Yes.
So you would have been like, oh, they made twice as many as they have been making, but they still lost the game. I don't like the fact with 180 yards rushing that this was still a close game. You would think 2016, if Dallas had 180 yards rushing, they're going to blow you out, beat you by at least 17, 20 points. No, this team is not as talented. So even when they dominate with the running game, which they have to week after week, this was still a game that could have been won by either team at the end.
And this is, we talk about this all the time between college and pro. Almost all these games are going to come down to a drive. And the Cowboys made the plays. There's a reason that a 7-point line in an NFL game is considered a huge line. Like, these games are supposed to be 3- and 4-point games. But if you just looked at the box score and you say, all right, so Dallas had 10 first downs rushing the football. Forget any first downs passing. They only committed 2 penalties. Dak took care of the football. Wait, they needed a field goal at the gun to win? Like, that speaks to, A, this was the worst game I'd seen their defense play. I think their defense will be better. They allowed Stafford to basically have free reign during the game. And B, once again, their wide receivers were MIA. Like, you go down the butt, you say, oh, Dak had 255 yards. Well, Zeke had 88 of them. A tight end had 39. So you can go down and see. It's still, they're having to manufacture their passing attack. But Zeke now, I mean, he went into the game leading the league in rushing. He now is on pace for about 1,700 yards rushing. That is what they are going to have in order to be competitive, until they get more of a consistent effort in the passing game. And I don't think that's coming this year. But I do want to give Dak credit, because Dak was coming off the worst stretch of football in his career. Oh, and yeah, he played a clean game. He played a good game. He broke that awful 5 straight games with under 200 yards passing streak he was on. So Credit to Dak Prescott for playing well. And you could see the burden, his celebration at the end was he was excited, but also I felt relieved that they got this win when he came on the field pumped up as he did.
All right, we're going to talk a lot more about this game coming up. But on the other side, how much trouble are the Steelers in after losing to the Baltimore Ravens last night? Next on First Things First. We will get to the Steelers' struggles in a second, but first, Davion Davis of Sam Houston State with one of the most acrobatic one-handed grabs you will see.
Oh, no, that's nice. I was like, what is he throwing this? The DB's in better position.
Oh, my.
He could only catch this one with one hand. I don't prescribe to the one-hand theory, young people, but no one's listening.
Penn State, Ohio State, great game, great catch by Penn State's Juwan Johnson. Just incredible.
That's the best catch I've ever seen in long sleeves. In those long, they're almost loose-fitting sleeves. That's the best one of those I've seen, see? What? What?
I don't know. But that's a great catch. That's the best catch I've seen with a guy that's got an arm. This dude with a sleeve.
With long sleeves.
That was a great catch.
You don't usually see him like that.
Now, he dropped like 3 or 4 other ones.
Boise State's John Hightower makes a one-handed catch. Only needed one shoe to do it.
Oh, that's what flew off the screen was his shoe. I thought it was the ball bouncing at first glance. Because you see it right there. Oh, that's great. That's great.
That catch, that was better than those first two. Holding the defender with one arm, catching it with the other.
All right, on to the NFL. Tyrell Williams of the Chargers extends over the defense to make the catch.
Puts himself in a precarious position. Hell of a play, man.
Phillip Rivers throws it at the back of his head. Remember we were talking about that last week? When the DB and the receiver are running together, man, don't throw it over his head. Throw it right at the back of his head.
All right, finally, Jarvis Landry with the nice toe tap to get the touchdown.
What I like about this was they had a great play fake, but he comes off the ball and acts as if he's not going to do anything. He logs the DB to sleep, then he makes a little stick nod and sticks it in the back. The toe tap, professional.
I feel like he got 3 feet down.
At least.
That's a great play by Jarvis. Jarvis had some drops.
Now, this is a hard fall when you fall in that dirt now.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. I hate playing on those fields.
All right, moving on to Sunday Night Football. It was billed as a grudge match, the rivalry of all rivalries, Steelers and Ravens. And what we got wasn't exactly that. Joe Flacco led the way for Baltimore, throwing for 363 yards and 2 touchdowns. A little competition will do that to you. Big Ben struggled, throwing a pick and a touchdown. Turns out the Steelers do, in fact, miss Le'Veon Bell. Ravens win 26-14. Roethlisberger didn't sugarcoat his performance after the game.
I don't think I'm on the same page as anybody right now because I'm not playing well enough. I need to play better. Today was just a bad day at the office. We've all had them. I had one today, and I promise I'll be back to play better.
All right, Nick, how can you pinpoint what went wrong for Roethlisberger in the Steelers offense?
Well, they got lucky. This game was about to be a blowout. They forced that fumble on the goal line. The offense then all of a sudden gets in sync, and they're 14-14 at the half. And at that point, I thought, okay, you dodged a bullet. You've slowed the Ravens. Your offense is clicking. And then in the second half, the Steelers' offense went to sleep. 47 yards in the second half of a huge game. No running attack whatsoever. And really, they haven't had much of a rushing attack since that week one performance where they ended up tying Cleveland. And Big Ben wasn't sharp. It is, we talked last week how if the Patriots were to lose, it would be panic time in New England. Oh, it's panic time in Pittsburgh. This team, they cannot defend the deep ball. The Ravens, they were lucky the Ravens only scored 26 because they were 1 of 5 in the red zone. They were holding them to field goals late. And Tucker's just automatic. He's unbelievable. But the Steelers right now, what do they do great? In this game, it should have been the aerial attack. They couldn't get on the same page as Antonio Brown. Antonio Brown, after the game, says, can't throw it to myself. Like, so there's that ain't great. L. Bell's not there. The defense is having troubles, and they don't lose these games. Big Ben's 21-3 at home in primetime games in his career. Like, big games at Heinz Field, they don't lose. This is everything went wrong in the second half for Pittsburgh, and I don't have a lot of answers for them right now. Right now, they look to me to be the most disappointing team in football.
The Pittsburgh Steelers right now, they don't have any physicality. They don't run the ball well, and they don't play good defense. They haven't played good defense for a while. Now, people will make the excuse they lost one of their best players defensively, Ryan Shazier, in last year. But they had the whole offseason to build, try to replace him. They haven't been able to do that. They have no identity. We talked about Dallas. What are they going to do offensively? No identity. Well, the Pittsburgh Steelers, when they get off the bus, who are they as a team? They're a collection of some superstars offensively, that being Ben and A.B. But besides that, like, who are they? Like, we didn't expect Connor to rush for 1,300 yards, even after that first game. But it's a classic example of, oh, the next guy up.
Yep.
Well, the next guy's not better than the guy who's not here. So this Pittsburgh Steelers team, this whole offseason, to me, has just been about who Pittsburgh's been the last couple years. A team that doesn't have an identity, a team that has inner team turmoil, and now with L. Bell telling the offensive lineman, hey, guys, I'm going to be there week number one. And now we're going to week number five. So I believe it's a bigger deal him not being there now because he actually told his players that he would be there. If I'm the Pittsburgh Steelers, I would try to trade him. I would try to move off of him as soon as possible to try to give this team, after a month of football, a lift.
They are indeed trying to trade him, but it's a tough situation for teams since they can't sign him this season, so it would be a very short rental. But how much of what happened yesterday would you put on Le'Veon Bell not being there? How much of the last couple games would you put on Le'Veon Bell not being there?
I think they had opportunities yesterday after halftime to win the game. I think they should have been able to win the game even without Le'Veon Bell. But you can't look at a game where they rush the ball 11 times and their long is 4 yards and they have 19 total yards rushing and not acknowledge Well, if you had one of the best running backs in football, it could have gone differently. A game where they're 2 of 12 on third down. They don't convert a third down in the second half. They don't get past midfield in the second half. Like, they, and say, what would Le'Veon Bell have been? And I fully agree with this. I understand that as a team, you have to have the mentality when a guy gets injured, it is next man up, that we're going to be okay. But that doesn't mean as commentators we have to buy into it. Like, we're not playing next week. And we can look at it and say there's a reason that there will be multiple teams fighting to pay Le'Veon Bell $12 to $15 million a year next year. And James Conner is right now exactly what a guy at his point in his career, drafted where he was, is supposed to be, a below-league average running back. Like, that's what they went from, one of the three best in the league to a guy who's slightly below league average. You don't magically make up that yardage. You don't magically make up that offense.
Is it possible that the Steelers will look at what happened yesterday and say, hey, guys, did we get this wrong? Maybe this is the guy that maybe we should rethink our strategy here with Le'Veon Bell.
No, they're not going to give him a long-term contract. I don't care how many games they lose. They can not win a game the rest of the year. They are not going. You cannot put those types of dollars and those types of guarantees into a running back who has the number of carries he's already had on him. Nick mentioned there's some other team, but he doesn't have history with the other team. He hadn't been suspended a couple times with another team. So, yeah, someone's going to take that chance. I don't believe the market's as strong as people would like to indicate. So I believe there's still going to be trouble in trying to move this player for a second-round pick and a talented starter potentially. I don't believe that type of deal is going to be out there for the Steelers.
And I understand that there's going to be a lot of focus and discussion about Le'Veon Bell and the running back situation today, especially because of their rushing performance. Yeah. But one thing that's been consistent throughout the year is the back end of that Steelers defense. You can't make Joe Flacco look like it's the playoff run where they went to the Super Bowl. He and John Brown all of a sudden look like one of the best deep ball combos in football. The Steelers were lucky the Ravens only scored 26 points. It felt like the Ravens left points on the board multiple times by coming up short in the red zone. The defense right now is the biggest issue on the team because the offense, they still have Big Ben. But a game like yesterday where Big Ben has his worst game since week one, not a lot of paths to victory for them.
Steelers now 1-2-1 after losing to the Baltimore Ravens yesterday. Time now for Put a Grade On, and presented by CarMax. The Baker Mayfield experience was an up and down one yesterday. Threw for nearly 300 yards and two touchdowns. He also turned the ball over four times. Chris, put a grade on Baker's performance.
I'm going to give him a C. I would have flunked him, but he threw the ball too well. You can tell he's a star in this league. Being young in this league and lack of experience, especially with a team that hadn't won a lot. So it's different than taking over some different teams. This whole roster hadn't won a lot, and you could see that in the young quarterback yesterday.
Yeah, I'm going to give him a B. And if you didn't watch the game, you just look at the box score, you're like, how? With those four turnovers, two of them interceptions. Man, he threw the ball really well. One of the picks was tipped, and that ended up getting returned. He's got to be better with ball security. I understand that. But they scored 42 points. He was throwing dimes, and he had some bad drops. And Njoku dropped a bad one. Jarvis dropped a bad one. The Browns' offense is not why they didn't win yesterday. It was their defense and some officiating miscues. I thought Baker, if you're a Browns fan, you would have liked to win, but you got to be encouraged by Baker once again looking really good. I give him a B.
And we'll talk more about that game again in a little bit. But coming up, have the Patriots fixed all of their problems on offense? That's next on First Things First. It is one of the wildest endings to a regular season we've ever seen. It's going to take another day of action to separate the division champs from the wild cards. Then the NLDS begins Thursday on FS1. It's getting good.
Two game 163s.
I mean.
And then the wild card game. It's
crazy.
Unbelievable.
Sticking with baseball, now it is time for us to go viral. Giancarlo Stanton hit his 38th home run at Fenway over the weekend, and the Boston fan did not appreciate it. Throws the ball back from the Green Monster, guess what? Actually hits Stanton. And Stanton with the nod. Kudos to you, my friend. Look at this arm.
Henry Rowengardner got a contract off this years ago. The Chicago Cubs.
This is dangerous, man. They shouldn't allow people to throw the ball back in the field of play. It'd be no different than a guy throwing the ball violently up into the stands.
Okay.
Leave it for CeCe.
Let me ask you this. Since they do allow it, and it is part of it, he shouldn't be in extra trouble because his happened to hit Stanton. Like, they allow that. They allow if the opposing team hits a home run, you're allowed to throw it back in the field of play. You might say it's foolish.
Okay.
But since they allow it.
They got a lot of stupid rules in baseball.
Okay.
Just another.
Okay.
But it hit the one guy who's wearing a helmet walking around. It could have hit
and
one of the guys
who did. And it hit the only opposing team player. I mean, it's right. The Red Sox fan. It hit the only Yankee out there.
It only needs to happen one time.
I was just going
to
say, it happens one time and it's
put an eye out. You'll put an eye out. Dude.
Okay. I'm
it's
about
all
safety.
Fun and games.
I'm about safety.
Yeah, wear your goggles, wear your helmet, man.
All right, stories.
Safe work environments.
Here we go. Let's start your morning right. Saints improved to 3-1 with a win over the New York Giants. Alvin Kamara had 3 touchdowns, including a 49-yard run to seal it at the end. Giants fall to 1-3, which Odell Beckham referred to as frustrating. All right, CeCe, what did you make of Kamara's performance yesterday?
They used him the right way. I mean, they were concerned about the 4-game usage. They're getting Ingram back this week. And Sean Payton talking to him last week, they were concerned with the number of carries. So starting off this game, didn't utilize him like they did the first 3 games. But as the game went on, him running the ball between the tackles is unexpected. An undersized right. running back, a scat back, and how they're utilizing them, the way they design their plays is brilliant for them. That's why they've been so successful.
Their ability in the second half to use him the way they would use Mark Ingram was spectacular.
They have a great offensive line, too. People don't talk about it, but that offensive line really helps Drew Brees.
19 for 134 and 3 touchdowns on the ground. That offense right now looks as good as any offense in football, and they're getting Mark Ingram back.
All right, on to the Packers and Bills. Packers and their throwbacks. Shutout, Buffalo, 22-0, behind nearly 300 yards passing from Aaron Rodgers. Josh Allen struggled in his third start, throwing for 151 yards and 2 picks. Nick, let's start with Aaron Rodgers. How do you think he looked?
Rodgers looked good. He made a few of those patented Rodgers throws where he's running and then just flicks the ball, it looks like, and it goes 30 yards in the air perfectly. This, to me, though, I couldn't watch this game and not think about the last week's game against Minnesota. Like, this Bills team is exactly who we thought they were. They showed it again yesterday. I mean, Aaron Rodgers said after the game he was disappointed in the offense. Then the game they won 22-0.
Yeah, he should have been. He's starting to practice a little bit more. You could see that participating in Thursday. So now you start to see his mobility come back. Without a setback, we'll see him just start to get a little healthier. You could see it in yesterday's game against Buffalo.
All right, moving on to the Falcons and Bengals. How about Cincinnati now sitting atop the AFC North with a 37-36 win? Andy Dalton threw for 337 yards and 3 touchdowns. It spoiled Matt Ryan's 400-yard, 3-touchdown game. See, how tough of a loss was this for the Atlanta Falcons?
The Falcons can't stop anyone. I mean, their offense is great. They're moving the ball around. Julio had another big day. Ridley has another score and everything, but they can't stop anybody. They got wholesale substitutions, linebackers out, nickelbacks out, safeties out. Like, this is going to be a week-after-week trend. How many points does Atlanta's defense give up?
And the Falcons are sitting at 1-3, and they're 2 plays and 1 coin toss away from being 4-0. Like, they got to be sick to their stomachs. Now, you're right that the defense, it's not like the knight in shining armor is coming. They have lost 2 safeties, the middle linebacker. But Matt Ryan's having a year almost equivalent to his MVP year, and the team just can't get stops at the end. Got to be incredibly frustrating for Falcons fans right now.
Finally now, Titans won a wild one in overtime over the Eagles. Penalties extended the drive for the Tennessee offense twice before Marcus Mariota found Corey Davis in the end zone for the game-winning touchdown. All right, CeCe, what'd you make of the Titans win?
Titans played well. They're a very physical football team. Mike Vrabel in his first year. They're 3-1, surprisingly. Only game they lost was that marathon game, the first one, where there was 2 delays, lightning, of course, the Chris Carter game to start the season against the Dolphins. But very physical team. Another team that has a lot of injuries. They've been battling their quarterback. But, man, it was a gutty performance by Marcus Mariota yesterday. I mean, him being able to make throws late in the game didn't look great throughout the game. But Philadelphia's secondary, they were bad. I mean, they were awful. Penalties in critical situation. They gave up a 4th down and 15 where they allowed the guy just to run a deep out. Off coverage, the guy's off of him. Guy just kept going back. What do you think he's going to do? He's going to stop around the sticks. The under coverage didn't run to it. I mean, bad defensive football.
How does that 4th and 15 happen, C? Because it looked like they were in the defensive alignment. They had four defensive backs lined up.
They got a new guy playing in the nickel spot. All he's got to do is run under the number one. There's only one receiver to his side of the field. He's outside of him. All he's got to do is back out. He sees he's running the out run right underneath it. Just their secondary, their nickel and their dime are really struggling.
This, Philadelphia, listen, credit to the Titans. They made the playoffs last year. They won a playoff game last year, and they were a forgotten team heading into this year. I think they got better at coach. Vrabel made some gutsy, correct calls in the overtime on fourth
correct,
down.
Correct, because they were.
No, well, no, I mean, I.
Yes. The,
if
absolutely.
They, if they did
everybody's
work,
got guts when
yep,
they work.
When they work. When they don't, you're just the Colts and you're Frank Reich. But
yeah, I've been on the sideline telling the coach, let's go for it. Let's go, coach. And it's like, no, we shouldn't have went for that one. But
okay,
go ahead.
Well, it's fine if you want to judge them in hindsight. The way I like to judge
well,
them
well, that's
is,
the way we always judge things, Nick.
Okay, well, that's not the way I judge the fourth down calls. We'll see that when we talk about the Colts game. But there are some calls that are just mathematically correct or incorrect. He went with the math every time. The 4th and 15, there was no math there. It was they were down 3 points in overtime. If you have no choice but to go for it. But he has done a good job. And credit to the Titans, who are 3-1 despite having bad quarterback play throughout the season, basically. I mean, they've had a quarterback injury. But the Philadelphia thing, to me, C, is the bigger part of this story, which is last week they barely hold on to a win after they let Andrew Luck drive down the field and then they get a stop in the red zone. We saw them this week. They're up 17-3 in this game. You can't be up 17-3 and let this Titans offense come back. And they had multiple chances to get off the field with the win in overtime. They had to convert 3 fourth downs in overtime for the Titans to win that game. I mean, if you're Philadelphia, I think you are very concerned about where your pass defense is.
Philly fans were up in arms about just that. How is it that you come out and play so poorly defensively when for the most part, for so long, that's been sort of their bread and butter all last year leading to this one? Is that coaching? Is that personnel? What is that?
Their secondary played above their ability last season. Yep. They had a good vibe. They made a lot of plays. And their pass rush was ferocious. They had a rotation of 7 guys. That Fletcher Cox is probably the only guy on the defense, him and Malcolm Jenkins, that are playing good football. Collectively, they just don't have enough people. I don't see the consistent rush from the other people outside of Fletcher Cox. So, also, remember how – I know Coach Mangini talked about this, too. Remember how they talked about how much fun it is in Philadelphia?
Uh-huh.
How much fun is it now?
It's true.
How much fun is it today? All right, since this whole offseason was all, man, it's so much fun. We have so much more fun than New England. Okay, let's get used to winning, all right? You hadn't won any championships, and now you're telling teams, hey, you know it's got to be about fun. No, it's got to be about winning, and they don't have enough good football players playing well.
All right, speaking of New England, Patriots played a rare Week 4 must-win game yesterday, the always popular Week 4 must-win. Trying to beat the undefeated Miami Dolphins, didn't have to try that hard. Patriots handed Miami a 38-7 beatdown, snapping their 2-game skid, showing consistency on both sides of the ball for the first time all season. Tom Brady had 3 touchdowns, 2 interceptions. The only blemish, Rob Gronkowski had to leave with an ankle injury. He did not return. Here is Tom Brady after the game.
We haven't played well the last 2 weeks, and you know, we talked a lot about the things we need to do better, and we need to carry them over from week to week. So this game's great, but, you know, you got to turn the page once you learn from it, and, you know, you get focused on the next game, and you build on the things you didn't do well. You understand what they did well, and some other teams are going to see that too. So it's just a big – it's a long process. It's a long season. We've only played 4 out of the 16, and hopefully we're a lot better in October than we were in September, and we're going to need it because we face some good competition. And, you know, this was one that we really talked about and tried to get on track and got off to a fast start and played from ahead, which is, you know, most teams that play from ahead end up winning.
All right, so the Patriots solved all their problems. Let's move on to the next. No, but it certainly seemed that way from what we were reading, from what we felt, from Tom Brady's Instagram post afterwards. Spirits were much higher. Are the Patriots' problems maybe not a thing of the past, but a little less worrisome to you now after
this
convincing
win? No, the Patriots still got big problems. They got more problems going into the game, especially if Rob Gronkowski's hurt. The wide receiver, they ain't got no wide receivers. I mean, you think you're going to get Cordell Patterson, you're going to get them to drop coverage for the 55-yard? And if Gronk's not there, who's going to get open for you? So, no, let's not blow this out of proportion. They beat the AFC East, and they beat them all at home. So We were expecting them to be able to win the game. Miami didn't play the type of football game that they wanted to. But listen to the defensive coordinator. He said going into the game of Miami, he said, I don't know what New England's going to do, but I'm going to guess they're going to run the ball 30 times. And that's exactly what they did. We'll talk about all the other optics and everything, but the biggest difference was their ability to run the ball and run it with Sony Michel. He was the big addition that they've added to their team. And for them to be a good football team, they're going to have to get the ball in his hands. James White is not a runner. Barner, who they signed, Kenyon Barner, he's not a runner. They only got one runner, and that's Sony Michel. He had a knee injury in training camp that held him back. It's a knee that he's had problems with in the past, so it's something we have to monitor. But his ability to be able to run the football, they made that. That's what made this game the type of game that it was. Miami. In week number three, when they got to 3-0, they lost two of their interior defenders. New England knew that, so that's where they attacked them. This game plan was about what we need to do, what you're missing in defensive, and I'm going to try to exploit that, and that's what they did.
One of those defenders, famously defensive lineman, was lost trying to avoid the roughing the passer penalty. You remember watching that highlight of him blowing his ACL. You hit on it. The first thing I've written down here, ate them alive on the ground. I mean, 40 rushes for 175 yards, they went into this game. I'm very impressed by what Sony Michel was able to do because he only had 24 rushes the first 2 weeks of the season. He had 25 yesterday. You finally saw that first-round pick paying dividends somewhat for New England. But I take a slightly different slant than C as far as where their problems were and where they are now. Because they got this win, and now they do have Edelman coming back. And now, even though his impact was minimal, you saw that Josh Gordon at least knew enough about the playbook to where they felt comfortable activating him. He had two targets.
He ran the easiest route. Run a slant. One guy's run the slant. The other guy's going in the flat. The other things, running plays. When he was in the game, running plays because they're easy. Just block the guy over you. So thinking he's going to make another big jump, I would just reserve a little bit, even seeing him out there. I could see they doctored up the game plan just to have him on the field.
But fair enough. But my point is the fact that he was able to be active. That is the first step, obviously, to him ever making an impact with the team.
I mean, but we still don't know who he is, though.
Agreed.
We don't know what kind of receiver he is.
I agree with you. But it's him being active is a step in the direction towards him contributing more so than if he was inactive like he was in week three. But Edelman coming back, to me, is an enormous part of this.
Especially if Gronk isn't 100% or active at all.
And the Gronk injury, the Patriots obviously are going to be as cagey about this as the league allows them to be for as long as they can. So we probably won't get any information on that for at least a couple days. But the other side of the ball, we spent a good portion of last week talking about how much speed the Dolphins have. And the Pats made Ryan Tannehill look like he's looked every game he's played in that building. They made Ryan Tannehill look like the quarterback that prior to this streak that was ended the 2016 season, started this season, had a lot of Dolphins fans hoping to move on from Ryan Tannehill. The Pats defense, totally eliminated any of the playmakers from the Dolphins offense. To me, they had the most complete win of any team in the league yesterday on both sides of the ball in a game that was a critical game for them. Go ahead.
Week number three, the word was desperation, and that's what was in Foxborough yesterday.
Yes.
They know they can't lose that game. Miami understands the game. All right, the game planning with the running game and Miami just could never get enough first downs. 1, 2, 3 first downs, get into the opposition's territory to be able to take advantage of that speed. So New England right from the beginning played a very, very good football game.
And the third downs were the biggest difference. The Pats were 10 of 15 on third downs.
Yep.
And if you watched it, it wasn't a lot of third and ones. It was third and six. It was third and seven. It was third and five. And they were picking them up consistently. And the few times they didn't pick them up, there seemed to be a holding penalty or an illegal contact penalty that gave them a new set of downs.
In this game, if you watch Tom Brady, and the reason why I don't say they're not out of the woods, watch how many times Tom Brady threw the ball away or threw the ball in the area where there was no one there. All right? The offensive line couldn't hold up. He was trying to make good decisions and he at least five times threw the ball where there was going to be no one there. And the reason why? Because no one was getting separation on the outside.
When you look at these two teams, Dolphins had played well. Yesterday was a terrible game. Patriots had not played that well. Yesterday was a great game for them. Were these both outlier games, or are we starting to see more of who these teams' identities actually are?
We have to be careful, all right? We know the Patriots coming into the season are going to use the first 4 weeks I believe Miami's a much improved team. I believe they are a legitimate contender in the AFC East for the first time since the Jets, when the Jets had Sanchez and Ryan coaching them. So Miami's a better football team. You can't draw too many conclusions from one game.
Done. Word of God. Coming up, should Andrew Luck point the finger at his coach for yesterday's loss? That's next on First Things First. Back here, First Things First, former head coach Eric Mangini joins the show. Hey, coach.
How are you?
Great day of football yesterday. Let's talk about one of those games. Okay. The one in Indy, the one where the Colts played the Texans, the one where Andrew Luck tied the game with less than a minute to go. Fast forward to overtime, 4th and 4 from their own 43, less than 30 seconds left. Indy doesn't convert. Frank Reich opts to go for it. The decision did not pay off. Texans kick the game-winning field goal 3 plays later for their first win of the season. Went through that pretty fast, but Colts head coach Frank Reich explained his decision after the game.
We're not playing to tie. I mean, we're going for that 10 times out of 10. I mean, that's just the way it's got to roll.
We discussed earlier, coach, whether we're analyzing these games in hindsight or moving forward, but what did you make of his decision there?
I didn't like the decision at the time, and I understand the idea of being aggressive and not playing for a tie, but when you've gone that far into the game and you put your team in a position to at least come out of it with a tie and you make that decision where they made it, you know that if you don't get it, odds are that the other team is going to be able to convert and the other team's going to win the game. And the play call itself seemed pretty uninspired. They came out initially, there was a timeout, and then they run hitches at the sticks against press coverage. It didn't feel like that was a decision
that he said was his only regret, that he called a timeout, that they should have just moved forward with it as if.
Yeah, I thought the initial formation, at least you had some potential against man-to-man defense to get some type of rub routes. That what they came out with the second time was a very standard sticks-type play against press man-to-man coverage. Didn't seem high percentage, and the whole situation felt more reactionary than the thought process of no matter what happens here, we're going to go for this. And saying we're not going to play for a tie, would they have done the same thing if it was 4th and 6? What if it was 4th and 8? What if it was 4th and 10? Were they going for it on 4th down no matter what? And did he tell the play caller on 3rd down, hey, whatever happens here, this is 4 down territory? Because that affects things as well. And the quarterback, he needs to know, I've got 2 downs here as opposed to 1 down. And none of that felt like it was happening as it unfolded.
I don't think that it was the right call to go for it. But there were way worse coaching calls all throughout the day in the NFL. Calls that are no-brainers. Calls like to call a timeout at the end of the half. The Giants and Steelers blew that. The Texans in this game themselves, before overtime and during overtime, calls that aren't a questionable decision. And the way this was covered during the game, as if Frank Reich was coaching malpractice, I think is totally unfair. I understand why he would do it. He's feeling, if I punt the ball here, we have 0% chance to win. If I go for it, now they still have about another 15 yards to gain. They didn't have timeouts. That's why I didn't love the decision, was even if they pick it up, you still might end up with a tie. But the other side of it is, if we don't get it, the Texans are going to have to execute. They're going to have to get at least 10 yards in about 20 seconds in order for them to have a field goal, because they were not in Kyeem Fairbairn's field goal range from that moment. So I understand why he did it. I don't think it was the right call, but I don't think it was an egregious call the way I felt it was discussed during the game and the commentary after the game. It was treated as if it was a no-brainer that he made the wrong decision. And if he's looking at the division and saying, man, a tie is as good as a loss if we're trying to win this division, if we're trying to catch Jacksonville or catch Tennessee. Like that half game is not going to help us. It's having a half game more in a loss column is not going to hurt us as much as having a half game more in the win column would help us.
Coach Mangini, I know this is going to shock you. I totally agree with you. And the reason why, because I didn't think the team knew. And Brian Billick used to always tell me something. Chris, if you want to be able to suggest plays to me in critical situations, I need you to think like me. I need you to memorize all of our critical throws, all of our 3rd down, all of our red zone. And when you can do that, then I'll let you have more input. I know you have a great football mind, and I respect it and everything, but if you want to have better communications on Sunday, I didn't think that the third down call was synced up with we're going for it on fourth down. And I don't have my number one wide receiver. I'm going to tell you what they ran. Now, they ran rocket right or double right, all stops. All right? When you have a fourth or third in 4-6, it's all stop. It's a customary route around the NFL. Everyone runs it. All right, critical situation, but you don't have no wide receiver that's going to be able to get in and out of that collision because he's only right 2 yards beyond the chuck zone. So you know they're going to play man. No one is going to play zone on fourth down. No, they're going to play man-to-man. So the stop route against man-to-man, it is not unless you have a number one guy or a big physical guy or a big tight end. They didn't have those. T.Y. Hilton is on the bench with a bad hamstring. So that's the reason. Not because you don't like it. Not because they didn't get it. Number one, it wasn't synced up with the team. And that defense, it's irresponsible to them to make them have to go out there and make one more stop. All right? You didn't get the first down on three. Punt it down. All right? Because the defense gets a tie. And when you go back into the office and you didn't lose in that half a game, it's a big difference the next week. So, Frank Wright, I believe it was a bad call, all right, because sometimes a tie is necessary. And in that game yesterday, a tie was necessary if they didn't pick it up.
Yeah, and a couple things here. We don't know what a tie is going to mean to this division at this point. We've got a long way to go, and I've heard the comparison between, okay, he was in Philadelphia and they were aggressive in the Philly special. That wasn't the Philly special. That was literally a play that says, my guy is better than your guy, and that matchup –
and
that
Coach Philadelphia is going to be able to bring that rush. Their defense was playing better. So a lot of time when you make an aggressive call, it's because Bill Belichick, I'm afraid of Peyton Manning. Or I got a great freaking defense.
Yeah, it's one of those things. And to evaluate the call in the context of other mistakes that other people made, I don't think that's the way to look at a call either. I don't think we say, well, other people made mistakes the other day. And look, if he felt good about that call, if that was a gotta-have-it play that they practice, if Andrew Luck knew what they were going to do, if they liked the matchup, if they were doing all those things, then I say, okay, go ahead and take that chance. I totally get it, and I'm never going to criticize someone for doing that because that's their thought process,
yes,
and they believed in it. But it didn't feel like they had gone into that situation saying, this is what we're going to do if we get to fourth down. And in critical moments, you need to be definitive and strong, and the guys need to know what they're doing.
I wholeheartedly agree with that. And if we want to pick apart justifiably, I think it's critical to know if you're going to go for it on fourth, that affects your third down call. That's what you're talking about, being synced up with the play calling. If we want to talk about their third down play call, the actual play they ran on fourth down, if they were doing the mental math of, even if we pick this up, how likely is it we get in field goal range? All of those things are totally fair critiques that I think are legitimate. It's why I said I don't think I would have gone for it. But the idea that in that setting, that fourth and four with 27 seconds left on your own 43-yard line in a tied overtime situation, that it's a must punt, that I reject flatly. Now, because T.Y. Hilton's out, because of other extenuating circumstances, what they ran on third down, I understand why there's criticism. But there is a logical case to be made in that spot that you go for it because even if you don't get it, you still, all you have to do is make one stop defensively and the game, and it's a tie either way. So now you can say they don't have the defensive personnel. There's a lot of reasons to criticize it. And the reason I brought up the other situations was we're not going to lead a segment talking about some other coaching decisions that were not questionable. They were no-brainers, and the Jets punted down 12 with 4 minutes left in a game. Like, that's a no-brainer. You can't do that, and they did it. So there were a lot. Frank Reich's getting killed today and will be killed today, and I don't know if that part of it's fair.
And also, it's important to note that a lot of the players that were interviewed afterwards said, we love the fact that he had such faith in the offense and he was being aggressive, and we love that.
They have to do that. Okay. They have to do that. You can't throw the coach. Even if the coach makes the wrong decision, you all have to be in sync. That's a good organization. That means they're buttoned up in comments. Even the stuff that you're not happy with, you're still going to say, I'm gonna help my guys. This is also Frank Wright. It's his first job.
Right.
So the players did a good job of that after the game.
I got to ask you about Andrew Luck real quick. Where are we now 4 games in with Luck after what you saw yesterday? Is he on the same trajectory we thought he'd be on when this season started?
Well, we didn't really know what trajectory he would be on. He's obviously playing at a much better level each week, and we're going to have to give him some time, not only with the injury, but also with the fact that this is a new offense, and that's going to take a while for him to get in total sync with what they're trying to achieve, how they're trying to achieve it. His numbers are a little bit down from the previous year, but it's trending upward. It's definitely trending upward. And I'm a big Andrew Luck fan, so I might be a little bit biased here, but I do see more and more positive things.
Yeah, he can quarterback my team.
He can quarterback my team too. and then the main thing is the injury doesn't seem to be on his mind anymore. And that's what I was looking for in the early part. How much is he really factoring that in? And it doesn't seem to be a factor at all.
When Andrew Luck was last playing with the Colts, they were a different offense. T.Y. Hilton, Moncrief, Gore, Philip Dorsett, and a tight end. Now, they don't have a whole bunch of talent. So when you start evaluating Andrew Luck, evaluate 400 yards, 40 completions to 9 different receivers.
Yep.
All right? Dude can play for me.
We talked about it, a step backwards in his road to recovery. I thought yesterday was an enormous or a couple steps forward. He had 450 yards, 4 touchdowns, and no picks, and his team lost. That's the only second time that's happened since the merger. Like, he played well enough to win. They had no running game. There were 17 of 41 on the ground. They lost T.Y. Hilton, as you mentioned. Luck played. There are a lot of reasons the Colts lost that game. Andrew Luck's nowhere near on that list. He looked excellent. And, I mean, they had him throw the ball 62 times. Like, it's a big ask, and he was great, I thought.
All right, Coach, stick around. Coming up on the other side is the key to success for the Cowboys. Less Dak and more Zeke. That's next on First Things First. Back here with Coach Mangini. Cowboys got some mojo back yesterday playing the Lions. And Ezekiel Elliott, the story in this one, carried the ball 25 times, gained 240 total yards, scoring once. Most importantly, had a 34-yard catch to set up this. The game-winning field goal. Dak was happy. Cowboys win it 26-24. Dak threw for 255 yards, 2 touchdowns, as the Cowboys now sit at 2-2. Here's Ezekiel Elliott discussing that pivotal catch after the game.
Honestly, I've been trying to get that play for a while. We ran a couple of times in practice and it hit, but once I saw we got in 2-minute offense and they were playing man-to-man, they had a linebacker lined up on me in the slot, I just knew I was telling the guys on sideline, give me the inside fade.
And you got Zeke on a linebacker. We're going to take that matchup any day of the week. Doesn't matter who the linebacker is.
Now that catch over his shoulder, when it all counted, should be one we all remember. And I'm glad I got to see it. But I've never seen him play any better than he played today.
2-2 is much better than 1-3, and it was great for us just to come out here, get things going offensively, and just be able to go down there and win that game on that last drive. It's big for everybody's confidence and just moving forward and momentum that we can take from this game and carry on.
Coach, did the Cowboys finally realize what it seemed like we all realized earlier, that the key to success is going to be just running the ball and getting Zeke more carries than not?
Yeah, you look at some of their early games and they were in a significant amount of empty, where now Zeke really isn't a threat at all and they don't have to worry about the running game. You're thinking, what's the benefit of doing this? And by putting him in the backfield, in committing to running the ball the way that they did, everybody's going to have to load up the box. And it's not like this is some big secret that you have to load up the box against Zeke, but for them to commit to it was a step in the right direction. And then the zone runs or the run pass options, I think those are important too to keep incorporating and try to take advantage of not only him as a threat as a runner, but also Dak as a threat as a runner too, and try to open up some things, because they've got to generate ways to get the outside guys open. And the best way to do that is to get everybody to commit to the coverage on the interior part, the running game between Zeke and Dak.
During the break, Coach, we were talking about your son's football teams and your junior high, and they played a team that had one guy that was clearly bigger and better than everybody, and that team just kept giving him the ball. Like, this is a tale as old as sports. Give your best player the ball as often as possible until the other team can stop it, and then go to your counterpunch. Don't go to your counterpunch ahead of time. And the Cowboys had been counterpunching instead of punching weeks 1 through 3. Zeke's carries 17, 15, 16. That was egregious coaching to go along with their quarterback struggling as much as he'd struggled as a pro. Yesterday, they give the ball to Zeke 25 times on the ground, and not shockingly, Dak has his best day through the air that we've seen from him in, what, 2 months' worth of football. This is the Cowboys' formula to success. Now, you can make the argument that it should be concerning that Zeke had the best game statistically of his career and they needed a field goal at the gun to win it, but the Cowboys at this point will take a win by any means necessary, and having Zeke be your bell cow is obviously what they need to do. It's going into the year. The reason we thought he could approach 2,000 yards was partially, CC, because he's special, but partially because we thought they were going to have no other choice but to run him close to 400 times.
They don't have any other
year.
Choice, and they didn't run him.
Right, the first 3 weeks. But yesterday, 150 on the ground, almost 90 in the air. I mean, that's a great game, and that's why the Cowboys won.
He had a great game, but I still think Dallas has two problems. One being they're not going to believe in identity of what happened last night. Like, are they going to grow that offense? Because with him being successful in the passing game, they had the big screen earlier, then you had to fade from the slot. How else do they grow his game passing wise? We know they got to run the ball, but where else is Scott Linehan going to come up with 5 or 6 different formations where you can throw the ball to Zeke? I don't think so. I mean, the same Cowboys, I believe next week, will go back. Zeke will have 15 to 18 rushes, a couple throws out of the backfield, because this is how they play. And they're going to struggle to be able to win games. Zeke is as good as he was in the passing game. 4 times targeted, 4 catches, 88 yards. He's their leading receiver.
Yeah.
Who else you going to beat on a given day where he's your leading receiver? Now, I believe in getting him the football. He needs 28 touches a game. But you still have a problem from a lack of wide receiver in this win. If we're just looking at it honestly, did Dallas figure something out? To me, no. Because even with his best game ever, they struggled and still should have lost this game.
Just real quick, let me ask you this, C, and I'm sorry to interrupt you, Coach. From a passing perspective, I did think schematically they were taking more shots downfield, which is what we talked about last week, that they have to take, you said, eight in the game, 2 a quarter essentially, where you give yourself a chance for chunk plays. And they did that in this week's game more than they had done in those 3 weeks. Now, it didn't change who's catching the ball on the other end of it, but I thought that gave them a better chance to move
conceptually,
the ball.
They changed just a little bit. But from a talent standpoint, it's still the same guys. They do not have a bunch of playmakers. I'm very disappointed in Hearns. His inability to get separation week in and week out just has not been there. Cole Beasley in the slot, like, he provided them just a little bit of a lift, but every week, like, Cole Beasley's going to be my number one guy. Like, so we're going to have problems.
One of the things that I do like about taking a shot is when you're loading up the box, when you are committed to the running game and people have to come up, then we saw it. We've seen it over time with great running backs. That does open up those opportunities to throw it down the field. But again, you need to be committed. If Chris, you were talking about 2 a quarter, you need to do that. You need to get the defense to think, okay, the safeties can't keep creeping up. Everybody can't keep creeping up, because you only need to hit 1 or 2 of those a game, and suddenly
right. Which they did.
Which they did.
To Zeke.
And so then now defensively you think, okay, do I really want to commit to this down in and down out of loading up the box, of moving everybody up, because then you get hit with those home run balls? It will be interesting to see what type of lessons they pull from this game. What do we see moving forward? Is this something they go back and they watch the tape and say it's an aberration, or do they go back and say, okay, this is who we need to be moving forward?
We were all down on Dak last week. A lot of fans had a hard time with just the way Dak's been playing. Do you feel any better about what you saw yesterday?
You have to get... Wait. First of all, these guys play how they play. It ain't our fault. It's our job to critique how they're playing. So Dak, like, if you're going to be a franchise quarterback, you're not supposed to be a roller coaster ride. It's supposed to be some smooth sailing. Or even when you dip, your dips are not so low. So how they play... Listen, it's not up for us to be, hey, man, they have to play better. Dak's got to play better. You saw his enthusiasm at the end. Man, he needed this.
He
was feeling the pressure. So it's not the outside, Dak knows he's got to play better. Nick and I, our commentary is not going to change.
And, right? And see, if Dak was a roller coaster, the last 5 weeks, he was the most boring roller coaster ever because there weren't any dips. It was just long, flat at the bottom. It was five straight games under 200 yards passing. So how do I feel? What I think is this. Dak had his best game he's had this season and one of the best games he's had since Zeke's suspension last season. Now, 255 yards passing and 17 completions would not be many guys' best game in a month, but it was for Dak. And so that is the type of stat line you want to see from him.
Barely won.
Absolutely. But the defense needs I anticipate the defense playing better typically. I think they got pressure on Stafford like 8% of his throws. He had a clean pocket the whole game, it felt like.
Yeah. DeMarcus
Lawrence was the only guy. I think he had three sacks, and I think those were almost the entirety of the pressures the Cowboys had the entire game. Point I'm making is less than 30 attempts, 220 to 260 yards passing. That's about what you should expect from a above average NFL quarterback. So all I've been saying is, can Dak be above average? Because we were talking about his stat line looked like Brock Osweiler's over his last 13 games. And that's a discussion you never want to be in. And it also, of course, helps when your best player has his best career day.
And they're going to have that discussion and figure out, is this our franchise quarterback? Is this the guy that we want to commit $100+ million to? Or is this a guy that needs 25 carries from our elite running back in order to be moderately effective? You need your quarterback, especially a guy like him who should be emerging each year. You need to get some sort of significant production, some sort of significant growth before you commit to him long term. Otherwise,
You need your quarterback to be a force multiplier.
Without a doubt. Or you also need to see growth. If he's not a force multiplier now, and maybe he's taking a step back, and sometimes young quarterbacks do that, you need to see some growth after they take that step back. And I don't know if we've seen very much of that.
All right, we've got to take a break. Coming up, can Mitch Trubisky make the Bears the best team in the NFC? Yes, we said that. Next on First Things First. Saturday, we got a big day in college football. First, it's the Red River Showdown between number 19 Texas, number 7 Oklahoma. Then Indiana takes on third-ranked Ohio State. Coverage begins at 11 a.m. Eastern on Fox and the Fox Sports app.
That Texas OU game should be awesome. Real chance for Tom Herman to kind of change the narrative surrounding his first couple years at Texas.
You don't believe that.
Well, if they win, he does. I just don't think they're going to win.
A couple of big plays from yesterday. Penn State, Ohio State. Great game, great catch by Juwan Johnson.
Look at that. Uses one hand C to fight off the DB.
Oh,
goes up and gets it.
Great catch. Great catch. Big wide receiver. Has questionable hands. Dropped three or four of them earlier. Man, what a great atmosphere. Whiteout Saturday night in Penn State. Man, it was a great atmosphere. Too bad they had to use them white shirts to be wiping them puppy tears.
I knew that was coming.
Hey,
look at.
This is Boise State's John Hightower with a nice one-handed catch. Only needed one shoe to do it, too.
Look at that. His shoe flies off. That's a spectacular play, man.
Boise State, Wyoming. That's as good as it gets. Keeping the DB with his right arm, keeping it around his shoulder. Sometimes as a wide receiver, we have to hold them.
All right, finally, to the NFL. Tyrell Williams of the Chargers extends over the defense, makes the catch.
It's in man-to-man coverage. Where a quarterback's supposed to throw it. See, what
throw
I tell
it,
you
throw
last
it right
week.
At the back of his helmet. Throw it right at the logo on the back so I can just eat it off of it. This is the way I used to steal apples from this little lady's house. I used to jump over the fence and then pluck them off the thing. Boop, 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 and get
How
going.
How far did you have to go from your house to the house that
Oh, you got to get
tree?
Out the project. You got
to
catch two buses and a train.
That's a long trek just to take some apples.
You're smart guy.
Must have been somebody, some girl's house on the way or
Ain't
something.
Ain't no apple trees in the hood.
No, what are you talking about? Maybe once you got to Ohio State.
We just take them from the cafeteria.
Okay.
All right, moving on to the Bears, who are quietly becoming the team to beat in the NFC North. Bears and Bucks. Mitch Trubisky had thrown for just two touchdowns this season going into Sunday's game. Yesterday, flipped a switch, threw for six touchdowns and a 48-10 throttling of the Bucks. Ryan Fitzpatrick benched at halftime. Jameis Winston came in, couldn't get it done. Bears win. They improved to 3-1. Here is Trubisky after the game.
That was the kind of the breakthrough that we were kind of hoping for and what we expect to do on offense. So it was just a lot of fun playing with those guys. It was a great team win all the way around, but it comes down to just having a great week of practice and having it transfer over to the game and just playing together.
He made some special throws, which I thought was great. And so when you're able to make those throws like he did today, you know, good things happen. And then again, our defense and our special team. So collectively, it was just really neat.
I think early on we thought, well, the Bears' defense is going to be great now. They got Khalil Mack, but Mitch Trubisky put together quite a game yesterday. Are the Bears maybe looking to be the best team in the NFC North?
If Mitch Trubisky can just be an average quarterback this year, then they absolutely can be the best team in the NFC North. The Vikings, I have real concerns about where their defense has gone basically since the NFC Championship game. That I understand the story last year is all these great wide receivers and it was Case and now they got Cousins, but that team's identity was defense. And it's been gone since that NFC Championship game. We know that the Packers are going to go come and go as Aaron Rodgers does. Now, typically that works out well, but that's not an overly talented team. The Bears have a tremendous defense. They've drafted well offensively as far as Tariq Cohen's an interesting skill position guy. Jordan Howard is a guy that you – I know yesterday didn't have a – I don't even think he played yesterday, but Jordan Howard's a guy that you can typically
rely on. Yeah, they've been utilizing him.
And then I like Trey Burton, Allen Robinson. The question was, did they whiff on their quarterback? The quarterback that they traded up to get, they were sitting at three. They wanted him so badly. They moved up to two, passed on Mahomes, passed on Watson. This is our guy. Is he bad was the question. If he doesn't have to do this, obviously. If he can just be okay, then could the Bears win 10 or 11 games? Yes. Could 10 or 11 games win that division? Yes. I just don't know if this is an aberration game or if this is the game it's like, oh, it clicked for Mitch Trubisky.
I think we have to be careful with Mitch. Mitch has big-time talent. He's got a big-time arm. We didn't study his draft as much as the draft the last with the five quarterbacks in the 2018 draft. But Josh Allen, if you look at the measurables, Trubisky's a little bit shorter. The arm talent. He has the same type of arm talent. Say Josh might be able to throw the ball further. But Trubisky has more talent, more variants of throws, and played at a higher level in college. He also has Matt Nagy as his head coach and offensive coordinator. Young, bright mind who came over from Andy Reid. So you could start to see. And the reason why I believe in him is not only because of his talent. I like the marriage with Nagy. You can see in their offensive formations, they believe in him. Compared to Tyrod Taylor a couple weeks ago, one of the good coordinators we know, a friend of ours, Todd Haley. Todd Haley was calling plays that told me he didn't believe in them. I can see how they line up in the formations. They're not trying to protect Trubisky and his arm by his decision-making. They spread the field, multiple formations, motion. They run a little version of what Kansas City and the Rams have been running. So I believe with the combination, this is the year that the Bears can be the best team. And the reason why is not just the offense. They finally have an answer to Aaron Rodgers. And it's not their offense. It's not Trubisky. It's Khalil Mack.
Another.
Because Aaron Rodgers has annihilated the Packers versus the Bears for a long time. But now you bring Khalil Mack in there. So now the number count is to the Bears' favor because you have to leave another guy in to be able to block him. So the Bears, yes, they can win the North.
The Chicago Bears right now have a better record than the Packers, the Vikings, and the Lions in that NFC North. Could you squint hard enough to see them sustain this all the way through?
If they get any type of production from their offense, yes, because what you said about Khalil Mack. Mack has played four games for them. He has four strip sacks? Four? Now, there was a year that I think was Robert Quinn that had for the – Robert Mathis, pardon me, not Robert Quinn. Robert Mathis for the Indianapolis Colts. He had four in a row during a middle part of a year, and it was a big deal. He's played four games for Chicago. He's four for four. Like, they already were a good defense. They added the linebacker, Roquan Smith, before they even knew they were going to have –
maybe the best NFL-ready linebacker coming from Georgia when they selected him. A little holdout. People necessarily didn't talk about him because that was before they got Khalil Mack, but he's going to be a star in this league for a long time.
And listen, people in Chicago were borderline panicked about Trubisky. I know this will shock you. One of my best friends does radio in Chicago, so I follow that a little closer than I do a lot of cities.
He's got two friends, one in Chicago, one in Pittsburgh.
Yeah, my only two friends. Luckily, we talk about the Steelers. Now we're talking about the Bears. I'm locked in. So, but they saw Pat Mahomes have a great game and then another great game. They saw Deshaun Watson last year have a few great games. It's not just that Mitch Trubisky had struggled. He had never had a great NFL game. He's played last year more than, obviously, Mahomes and even more than Watson. He started this year. They bring in the offensive coordinator from Kansas City. It's one of the reasons it looks like they're running some of the Kansas City stuff is Matt Nagy was in Kansas City. And he was – there was questions in Chicago about whether he can even throw to the left side of the field. They were panicked. And now, obviously, they're going to overreact on the other side of it. But I don't think he has to be great. I think he could be the worst quarterback in the division, and they still could win the division as long as he's not one of the worst quarterbacks in football.
I'm going to tell you what you don't want to do. In the NFC, you don't want to go to Green Bay. But, man, you don't want to go to Chicago when they got a good defense late in the season. Week number 14 and 15, yeah, I looked at the schedule. I'm getting ahead of myself. Who they got coming in, Nick?
The Rams come in 14.
Week 14.
Yeah, and Green Bay comes in 15.
Those two games right there are going to make their season. I believe the Bears are a playoff team. We have to make sure we adjust our eye. Them four teams that emerge after that first month, adjust your eye. Those are the real teams. So we can pick out three or four of them. I believe the Bears are the one with the adjustments they made. And Khalil Mack, man, he's a franchise changer.
And let's not forget, the 3-1, the one is the Aaron Rodgers comeback.
Yes.
The one is a game that they had dead to rights, and then Aaron Rodgers went Aaron Rodgers on him.
If so Khalil Mack had been in training camp for three more days.
Right. It would have been – it's a lot easier to see how this team could be 4-0 than 2-2.
Who's like, next up for the Bears now?
They have a bye this week, and then they got Miami. They go to Miami and then a home game against New England that all of a sudden looks like a potentially really good Week 7 game.
All right, got to take a break. Coming up, Earl Thomas has an interesting gesture for his team. That's next on First Things First. Down for stores to start your morning, Titans. Outlasted the Eagles in overtime, 26-23. Both quarterbacks threw two touchdowns, over 300 yards. Nick, how surprised were you that the Titans upset the Eagles?
I was very surprised, and I think the Titans are a good team. I picked them to go to the playoffs, but I thought for Philly, they knew they escaped with one last week against Indy. Now they've got Carson Wentz, a little less rust. And this game was going exactly the way I thought it would, which was Philly choking out the Titans' offense until it didn't. It was 17-3.
Yes.
You can't blow
one play away.
I mean, it's 17-3, and then you have them in 4th and 15 in overtime to get away with one, and you give up one of the easiest routes to defend in football. This is a great win for Tennessee, but a horrible loss for Philly.
Yeah, I'm concerned about Philadelphia.
Yeah.
You know the reason why? The Super Bowl hangover is real, all right? There's a reason why in the NFL we don't have people repeat. There's a reason for that. And they've played bad football for 2 months because their preseason was really bad. And we just thought, oh, because they're so talented and they hit the regular season, they'll turn it on. But four games, should have lost week number one.
Both of their wins, the other team had the ball inside the 20, down less than a touchdown.
Moving on to the Falcons and Bengals. How about Cincinnati now sitting atop the AFC North with a 37-36 win? Andy Dalton threw for 337 yards, three touchdowns. Spoiled Matt Ryan's 400-yard, three-touchdown game. Nick, how tough of a loss was this for the Falcons?
Add it to the list for the Falcons. They are two plays and one coin flip away from being 4-0, but instead they're 1-3. And Matt Ryan last week had the highest quarterback rating in NFL history in a loss. And this week he was almost as good or just as good.
Yeah.
And another team, hey, all you got to do is get a stop right there. There's 12 seconds left in the football game. You're up less than a touchdown. Get a stop. Couldn't get a stop. And it didn't seem like that was that hard of a route to defend either. Atlanta, you got to wonder if their season's on life support already.
Well, they got so many defenders. They got wholesale substitutions on that defense. Dan Quinn, man, and talking with him last week when I covered the New Orleans-Atlanta game, they got a Band-Aid on that defense. Last person with the ball against the Falcons, if they can score, you can beat them. Their offense, though, you got to be happy with the way Matt Ryan's playing.
And Calvin Ridley looks like a very good first-round pick.
The New Orleans Saints improved to 3-1 with a win over the Giants. Alvin Kamara had three touchdowns, including a 49-yard run to seal it at the end. So the Giants fall to 1-3, which Odell Beckham referred to as frustrating. Chris, what'd you make of Kamara's performance?
I thought it was a good performance. I know that Sean is trying to, Peyton is trying to manage his carries because they have Ingram out for the first four games of the season. Get him back next week. So you can see coming into this game, they didn't want him to have a heavy workload in that first quarter. Second quarter emerged, third and fourth quarter for an undersized running back. He's probably the toughest guy, pound for pound, that we have in the NFL that's not playing quarterback.
And shout out to Drew Brees. Another big game, which now puts it more likely than not, that he breaks the NFL all-time yardage mark in a nationally televised game at home next week. If he had to wait 2 weeks, it was going to happen on the road. I'd be excited if he got to do that at home. But this Saints offense looks as good as any unit in football. Pick your favorite defense, your favorite offense. The Saints offense near the top of the list. And it was good for them. Their defense finally played well.
First game.
First game. Now, maybe that's an indictment on the guys in blue that I know we'll talk about later this week. But excellent all-around game for New Orleans.
All right, finally, big game in college football. Ohio State came back from down 12 points with 8 minutes to go behind two touchdown passes from Dwayne Haskins. Trace McSorley had over 450 total yards of offense. But Penn State couldn't convert a 4th-and-5 to keep their final drive alive. Buckeyes win 27-26. Penn State head coach James Franklin described the difference between the two programs after the game.
We lost to an elite program, and we're that close. We have gotten comfortable being great. We will no longer be comfortable being great. We're going to learn from this, we're going to grow from this, and we're going to find a way to take that next step as a program because we've been knocking at the door long enough. And it's my job as the head coach. I'm ultimately responsible for all of it.
All right, CC, did Ohio State prove that they're the class of the Big Ten with the win over Penn State?
I don't think in beating Penn State that they proved it. I think that I said on the show all last week, Penn State gives Ohio State more problems than any other team in the Big Ten. There was a time where we struggled with Wisconsin just because of matchups and playing at Camp Randall's a tough place to play. They got 110,000 in a whiteout. That's a tough place to play. Their quarterback, and since they've added him to the lineup, you could see they're far more creative offensively. They don't throw the ball quite as well as they did last year because they lost a few guys to the NFL. But Penn State is a very, very good program. They represent the Big Ten well, and their quarterback has done an outstanding job developing as he's come through the ranks. And now his senior year, you're starting to see the best football that he's played. They got a couple athletes, especially offensively, that typically they wouldn't have. They have good team speed. They've never had great team speed. So you can see James Franklin's influence on that. And this is not Penn State, a dominant Penn State defense like they had last season. These are a bunch of guys playing on emotion. And they played a very good game Saturday night. Ohio State, with their athletes offensively, their quarterback didn't get shaken and made some throws late in the football game to be able to make a difference. Also, from a game planning standpoint, Ohio State deciding they're going to throw the ball a little bit sideways to build, when they were blitzing,
yes,
to build to isolate some of those non-athletes, Penn State in space, took advantage of them.
That was the biggest adjustment in game they made because much like last year's game, we were all there. This is a game that Penn State dominates early on. It looks like Penn State's going to get that signature win that James Franklin's talking about. And in last year's game, it started really at the middle of the third quarter, beginning of the fourth. This game, I mean, it's 26-14 midway through the fourth, Penn State. And then Ohio State did exactly that. They did start to use Penn State's aggression against them. There was one big play where the cornerback missed a tackle for Penn State out on the screen to the side. Receiver takes it to the house. But I know there's a lot of discussion, and you and I talked about it Sunday morning, C, about that play call at the end. And that is the type of call where if on 4th-and-5 you call a running play and it works, everyone is saying, wow, what a play call. What a gutsy play call there. Catch them off guard. Your issue was with you could see that this was not going to work ahead of time because of the Ohio State alignment.
Well, they called two timeouts before. Ohio State called one, then Penn State came back with one, changed formations, and Ohio State ran the stunt with Chase, the big defensive end from Maryland, to get in to make the play. But that is Larry Johnson Sr., former longtime assistant at Penn State. He's the defensive line coach for Ohio State. He runs that stunt to be able to take them out of that option game. We knew they were going to put the ball in the quarterback's hands with a read option. The other defensive end had the quarterback. That's why he gave it up, and Chase was there to stop him in the backfield.
All right, let's get back to the NFL now. Seahawks got a win over the Cardinals, but a key loss at the same time. Earl Thomas fractured his leg in the fourth quarter as he was carted off the field. Well, he flipped off the Seattle sideline on the way to the locker room. When asked about Thomas's gesture after the game, Pete Carroll said, well, it's a big stadium. Not sure where that was going. Earl Thomas's season is over, most likely his career in Seattle as well. He didn't do it three times. This is looped. Nick, what was your reaction to this?
This is going to be his last game in a Seahawks uniform, and it sucks that this is going to be the final image of Earl Thomas as a Seattle Seahawk. He's one of the great players, I would argue, in their franchise's history. You can make a strong argument that on that famed Legion of Boom, he was the very best player with respect to Sherman, with respect to Cam Chancellor, and defensively as a whole, with respect to Bobby Wagner. I think that was the best guy. But this is what he was afraid of. This is the reason why he was saying, and we laughed about it, like, hey, if I have a headache at practice, if I have a hangnail at practice, I'm not practicing. And unfortunately, this can happen. This is the same leg he broke a couple years ago, the same leg he has a rod in. And he will play football again. He'll play for someone else next season. It's obviously, you probably shouldn't flip people off on live television, your coworkers, I get it. But this is an incredibly frustrating moment that he was worried about all year long. And this is how his season ends, on the back of a cart, and the way his career in Seattle ends, on the back of a cart.
I wish we didn't see it. It's Earl's been a lot classier than that when he's at University of Texas, is a high draft pick in the NFL. Now, he's been in this dispute with the team over getting a contract extension, but the truth of the matter is Seattle's the one who drafted him. They're the one who put those other defensive players around them so that he can create the legacy that he has. The Seattle Seahawks has made him rich. Now, I don't know what they did to deserve that, but that's just not the way to go out. Even if he was disgruntled, even if they've had intense discussions off, there was no way to do that because it's not about Seattle anymore, Earl. That's your brand. It wasn't the Seattle Seahawks. That was Earl Thomas. It's not going to be an indictment on the organization. The coach tried to play it off. It's a big stadium. Don't want Bobby Wagner talked after the game saying, you know, it's an emotional game, and sometimes people act emotionally. You have to give them a chance to act emotionally. But this is bad for his brand. All right? Earl, you're bigger than that. Football's been good to you. Seattle's been good to you. All right? Don't get caught up in the business of it. All right? He's upset they didn't sign him to a contract extension. That's part of the business. You ain't the only one that didn't get a contract extension. But you can always – it only takes this much. And the difference between class and ASS, it's a big difference. But that's where Earl was right now. And he didn't know because that was not a classy move.
And it is a reminder, though, just kind of take the flipping the team off aside – of how quickly all these teams turn over. Forget Seattle's Super Bowl win. The year after the Super Bowl, they lost to New England. You know how many starters next week will be the starters from that game? Five guys. Russell Wilson, Bobby Wagner, Doug Baldwin, a couple offensive linemen. That's it. That wasn't a decade ago. That was less than 5 years ago that they played in that game. They have five starters left on that from the team that made its second straight Super Bowl and was a yard away from winning that Super Bowl.
I just don't like the fact of guys getting the business mixed up with the logo and the helmet because he's in love with Seattle. And because Seattle is a football club, all right? And they're going to make football decisions. And a lot of time when these guys don't get the contracts, they take it personal. Concentrate on the business aspect of it, man. It's not personal. None of these organizations love these guys. I tell guys when they come in the locker room all the time, you know the thing we have in common? One day they're going to take your nameplate down. They're going to take that jersey off your back, and someone else is going to be wearing this uniform. 99% of all NFL players need a system. 99% of us get knocked out of the game. Some of us going off on a cart like that. Some of us not because we don't have a contract. But ultimately, all of us are going out that door, and they're going to replace us. And Earl missed that.
Do you think what happened to Earl Thomas might influence some other guys who were approaching some semblance of a holdout scenario?
Well, I think that people are drawing the conclusion of, is this going to make Le'Veon Bell even more entrenched?
Right.
Le'Veon is as entrenched as can be, it would appear, absent of this. Now, What did come up last week is the fake trade that I proposed last week on the show, Le'Veon for Earl. It was reported by the NFL Network that Pittsburgh proposed that very trade and that Seattle, as you talked about, was not interested in doing that. And where it is a bummer is it was also reported yesterday by Therese Paylor that the Kansas City Chiefs were close with a trade with Seattle for Earl Thomas. And so, obviously, none of that's going to happen. No one's going to have Earl
Thomas. No, I don't believe players are going to follow. So, you know the reason why? Because Earl didn't win. He wasn't right. There's no precedent to, oh, this was very, very successful. No, it didn't work for Earl. It won't work for other players. All right? If you signed a contract, all right, you need to abide by that contract and believe that the team, a lot of times you're approaching 30, they're not going to extend you. Everyone's in love with all these extensions. This is just recent that this started happening. But typically, you have to play out that contract.
What I would say people could learn from is if it is true that Earl took a discount when he signed the initial deal, that speaks to the business side of it is as far as speaking against taking hometown discounts. Like, if you are in a position where you have leverage and you are a free agent, exerting every last bit of leverage sure. to get
but
every...
But also, if you don't take a discount, then maybe you're not playing with Richard Sherman. Maybe you're not playing with Bobby Wagner. Maybe you're not playing with Cam Chancellor. So when you take that hometown discount, realize at the end, there ain't no hometown. All right? Your hometown is actually where you came from. It's not that team. So you got to be careful in trying to negotiate and be able to live with the results.
All right, got to take a break.
Don't let Nick Wright negotiate.
Coming up, was Baker Mayfield's first loss his fault? That's next on First Thing.
Yeah, okay. Give me your list of clients.
Back here with Coach Mangini. Raiders, Browns, tight one here. Baker threw for two touchdowns, also turned the ball over four times. But the Browns had a chance to win this one, failing to pick up a critical third down that would have ended the game. Cleveland forced a punt. Raiders took advantage. Derek Carr to Jared Cook for the touchdown and the two-point conversion to tie the game at 42. Raiders would kick a field goal in overtime for their first win of the year. Here is Raiders head coach John Gruden after the game.
Feels like my first win in 100 years. You know, it's just great to be back. I thank our fans for hanging in there with us. There's a lot of, like I said, ups and downs, but to get that field goal with our third-string kicker, backup snapper, never been so nervous on a 29-yard field goal in my life.
Yeah, they scored enough points to win, but we gave them the opportunity to do so. You know, we turned the ball over too many times, gave them a chance. And in this league, when you turn the ball over like we did today, like I did, you're not going to win those games. And so we saw the end result of that.
All right, Coach, what was the key to the Raiders coming away with this win?
I think Baker nailed on the head the turnovers. The turnovers were a big issue, and the Raiders have been a team that haven't been very good in the second half, and actually they've struggled mightily in the second half, and they were able to overcome that for the first time this season and be productive in the second half. But it's one of the things that Baker did really well in college was protect the football. And one of the problems that the Browns have consistently had over the years is not being able to protect the football and having those self-inflicted wounds. And that's something that he's going to have to overcome moving forward.
The key to the game was the short field the Raiders on. The Raiders didn't have to go 20 yards on the second touchdown inside the 10-yard line on the first fumble. I think that was in the third quarter. I thought that Todd Haley and Hugh Jackson, that they did a disservice to Baker by on that first series when they had the ball backed up inside the 10, the first play they called was a pass play. Now, the right tackle gets knocked into Baker, pressure and everything, but if I run the ball, you can't get pressure. All right, I'm going to run the ball on them first two downs. I might throw the ball on second down, but I'm going to run the ball. I got a two-touchdown lead. There was no pass play for me with that field position that I'm going to put that young guy in the black hole, backed up in that end zone. Those are the loudest positions for those tackles to be in. And you could see that the seepage on that right side of the tackle, you got a rookie quarterback. Help him out. Run the football. You got a two-touchdown lead in those situations. Even if you run it three times and punt, you're not going to lose it. If they don't turn the ball over in those two possessions, yes, they win that game. The game doesn't get to overtime.
They had plenty of opportunities to win. Baker, who I thought actually, aside from the turnovers and that's a big yeah, but I get that, played well, made some really good throws. They scored 42 points. But they also had the ball to start overtime, and they couldn't go down and get points themselves. There are a lot of reasons Cleveland lost this game. But despite all those reasons, if not for two horrifying officiating mistakes, one of them is as bad of a call as I've ever seen, the in the grasp. I mean, it is a strip sack the moment the defender, it was Myles Garrett and 55, converge on Carr. And I think in this ongoing effort to make sure we're always protecting the quarterback, they called it in the grasp. He was never grasped. He was the defensive end came around, hit the ball. That's a touchdown the other way with 6 minutes left with the Browns already leading. And then late in the game, they use replay in a way it is not meant for. Where they use replay, replay is there to fix obvious mistakes. I think they made a mistake by changing the call. It certainly was not clear and obvious or overwhelming video evidence. Like, so despite all those things, if not for two bad referee mistakes, one of them the in the grasp, just unforgivable, the Browns win this football game. Like that, and as a coach like Hugh Jackson coaching for his job, like the lives are affected by this stuff. I don't know how you can justify that for those officials in that football game.
Look, there's officiating calls that we disagree with every single week, every single season. And then at the end of the season, it goes to the competition committee and we discuss it. That happens. I mean, Marshawn Lynch, they blew the play dead early when he was still running. And who knows where that run would have gone. And you could keep going back and forth and saying it was this call, it was that call. But at the end of the day, the Browns made enough mistakes to allow the Raiders back in the game in a situation where they shouldn't have. It shouldn't have happened. And Baker's right. The turnovers at the end of the day are what killed them.
Coach, but quickly, you're right that the we don't know what would have happened after the Marshawn play, and we don't know what would have happened after the in the grasp, which was a strip sack. We do know that if they don't overturn that first down, it's game over. It was kneel down time after that. We do know that, and that's, I would have to imagine as a coach, that is maddening. You run the play, you appear to get the first down, they appear to make a good spot, and then a booth review corrects something that doesn't look like it was wrong.
But if they went to the booth and they corrected it, they obviously felt it was wrong. And I'd be sick as a coach if they didn't go to the booth and they didn't correct it. You can look at it from either side. You could look at it from John Gruden's perspective or Hugh Jackson's perspective. And from John Gruden's perspective, they did the right thing. They went and tried to look at a call that was a game-deciding call and at the end of the day come out in the right place. And to me, that's what replay is supposed to be. Is it supposed to make sure at the end of the day everybody's getting a fair opportunity to have the game officiated correctly.
See, how much of this loss would you place on Baker Mayfield and those turnovers?
It's a combination. I mean, if you call a play, it's every coach I ever told me said, if I call a play, I believe that you can handle it. So some of it's on the player. He knows he's up by he knows he's up by two touchdowns. The problem is there's not a lot of people there have won games. That was a typical time. A team does not know how to win. So Baker don't know how to win the NFL. As much as he won at Oklahoma, there ain't no carryover. How you close out games in the Big 12 compared to how you close them out in the NFL.
So is that on Todd Haley then?
Well, I'm going to spread the blame around. If the coach calls a pass play to me, it's my responsibility to try to execute that pass play as much as possible. All right? It's also up to the coaches that we're in unison that we try to run the best thing. It's the right tackle's fault. It's Baker's fault. And it's the coordinator's fault. So we have to spread the blame around. It's not Todd Haley's fault. All the pass plays are good. I would have just helped the kid out. We're backed up in the black hole. We're up by 2 points. No, two touchdowns. Run the football. There's a way to win football games, and there's a way to lose football games. Watch Cleveland. Take it to the Pro Football Hall of Fame. Roll it out. That's a classic way to lose a football game by having a young quarterback turn it over in the third and fourth quarter.
And then you get the early two-point conversions at the start of the game. You wonder,
absolutely.
Well, why are you making those decisions at that point in the game? And you go and you kick the extra point. We're not even dealing with overtime. I mean, that's another thing that happened so early in the
game.
Then
the refs aren't involved.
Yeah, and so many other things happened after that. But you could look back at those and say, okay, well, why would you make that decision at that point? And you could argue, hey, we're being aggressive. We're, you know, like going for it on fourth and five and from your own 42-yard. You know, you could go that down that track as well. And there's an argument for that, too, if that's your philosophy. But at the end of the day, there's those decisions that you have to factor in.
Cleveland right now sitting at 1-2-1, and all four of those games, they at some point in the fourth quarter were favorites to win, heavy favorites to win. Like, I know it's too much to expect they could be 4-0, but they haven't lost decisively yet. But to C's point, like, they have found ways to lose or tie games that are almost new each week.
thank you for listening to the First Things First podcast. Remember, leave us a review and tell us what you think. Subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts and catch us on FS1 Monday through Friday, 6:30 a.m. Eastern. For Chris Carter and Nick Wright, I'm Jenna Wolf. So long, everybody.